Welcome to CSIS. I'm Sarah Mendelson, and I want to thank Human Rights First so much for contacting us. It's nice to see some old friends. I want to encourage everybody, we've got seats at the table, so please, don't be shy. If you want to, you can come sit at the table, particularly because we are recording this, and if you want to ask a question, we want to encourage you to use the microphone. We have what is really a long overdue panel on intolerance and discrimination in today's Russia, and we have the experts to discuss it. Alexander Vakovsky runs the Sova Center in Moscow. It is probably the most famous NGO following these issues. You've read about it many times in newspapers. And we're very pleased to be able to give a platform to hear the fine work that your organization is doing, tracking harassment and discrimination in Russia. We also have Tad Stanky from Human Rights First, and we're going to be discussing the Human Rights First report on Russia, and I suspect we're going to touch also on Ukraine, or mainly on Russia.
Mainly on Russia.
And U.S. policy, and it's a good time to be talking about U.S. policy and what U.S. policy ought to be. And we have Kathy Kozman, who has been with us many times from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. So I think we should we have a big agenda and a lot to talk about, so let's just turn it over. Do we have an order that we want to go in first? Do you want to have Sasha go first? Okay. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah, for the possibility to speak here. First, I have to apologize for my English, so I will mostly read the text. It would be easier for you and shorter also. I have to here to summarize recent information gathered by our SOVA Center on aggressive racism and the government response, and also on misuse of counteraction to extremism. Of course, it's impossible to talk about everything. We have our reports translated to English on our website and in this book for previous year. And I have to add that if somebody here reads Russian, it's better because our everyday news on the website are in Russian only. And I have several our books in Russian for those who is interested. First, I will start from violent hate crime as the most serious issue. Unfortunately, there is no system for documenting suspected racist or other biased motives at the moment of reporting of violent crime to the police, so there are no official statistics of hate crime in our country. The monitoring carried out by our SOVA Center only partially fills the gap. But the level and trend of the violence which we may fix, we may notice, are striking. 64 people were killed in bias-motivated attacks in 2006, 86 in 2007, and up to the beginning of November, we counted 80 people murdered this year. In citing these figures, it's important to keep in mind that many crimes are revealed long after the incident, so the number of violent crimes is likely to increase, especially into concern the current year. And people of Central Asian region continue to be the main risk group, followed by people from Caucasus. And also violent hate groups target anti-fascists and members of certain youth subcultures. Criminal prosecution for these violent attacks rates trail significantly behind the rates of hate crimes. According to available data, convictions are made in less than 10% of hate crimes cases which SOVA Center has documented. Since the actual incidence of hate crimes is slightly far higher, I'm sure at least twice higher, this rate of conviction is much lower. Furthermore, the number of these convictions has recently decreased, reversing to a positive trend for years 2004-2006. Though the number of racist attacks has increased by at least 15% per year in several last years when we do systematic monitoring, there were only 23 convictions reported last year, down from 33 in 2006. Why is it happening so? There are, of course, several explanations, but my main hypothesis is that it's because of extending, maybe paradoxically, of extending implementation of our anti-extremism legislation. I'll try to explain. The law on combating extremist activity has been detrimental to combating hate crime, since the law extends to a wide range of violent and non-violent and non-criminal even activities grouped together under the overly broad heading of extremist activities. The current legislation fails to establish hate crimes as one of the activities that should be a priority for law enforcement authorities. One may notice this absence of clear focus in speeches of many officials, from President Medvedev to any police officer. It becomes obviously particularly when reviewing the way in which the authorities have responded to incitement to hatred or hate propaganda. Of course, this type of propaganda is very dangerous and is closely linked to violent crimes, and Russian law contains provision, Article 282 of Criminal Code, that criminalizes incitement to hatred. In contrast to low rate of convictions for violent bias or motivated acts, the rate of prosecution for propaganda have been growing rapidly. If we consider year 2005 as a baseline, it was the first year when sentencing for racially motivated violence significantly improved compared to all previous years. The number of convictions for racist violence fluctuated slightly. It was 17 sentences, convictions in 2005, then 33, then 23, and this year also 23 up to the moment. While conviction for propaganda, for hate propaganda, consistently increase for the same years, it will be 20, then 17, 20, 17, 80, 20, 29, and 37 up to the moment this year. We do not take into account convictions where we believe the law was clearly misused. However, the apparent desire to improve the statistics of convictions has led to an ever-increasing number of sentences for propaganda meted out for minor offenses such as graffiti on walls or even posting on web forums and blogs. I mean racist postings, but it was just very not dangerous, I would say, offend. At the same time, people who have engaged in consistent and extremely aggressive racist propaganda for years, openly agitating for discrimination and even the use of violence, have gone unpunished. I have to say several words about activities of radical nationalist groups. There are some new interesting trends here also. After previous parliamentary election in December last year, the public activity of right-wing radical groups slowed down because the hopes of returning to big politics were shattered as the parties were excluded from the election and several particularly active neo-Nazis were prosecuted. The participation in last Russian March on November 4, its annual march which traditionally brought together right-wing extremists, was less numerous as compared to previous year. On the other hand, pro-Kremlin youth movements have recently been turning to anti-immigrant rhetoric. This applies to larger movements such as Young Guard, Молодая Гвардия, which is a youth organization of United Russia Party, and the Young Russia Movement, Россия Молодая. The latter activists has insisted that, I quote, migrant workers should be expelled from Russia. The movement locals, местные, has organized several explicitly racist demonstrations and with the racist slogans, racist pictures. At the same time, this young guard of United Russia Party had struck an alliance with the locals. And the locals at the same time joined forces with the new organization Russian DPNI, which is a radical fragment of movement against illegal immigration, which split into several fractions this year. So we see some kind of continuity in the spectrum of nationalist youth movements. This rapid and simultaneous shift in the policies of pro-government youth movements appears to be driven by the Kremlin policymakers, indicating that the authorities continue the manipulations of nationalists. As we observed in late October and early November, some, I would say, puppet political groups like Young Guard have been appointed to serve as civilized nationalists, they themselves call themselves this term. But actual moderate nationalists like People's Union of Sergei Baburin have been permitted to march, but on a hard-to-reach embankment far from center, and they were marching side by side with their neo-Nazi allies. At the same time, right, police dispersed marches of more radical nationalists who declare, what mean radicals? They declare themselves to be a radical opposition. I mean the movement against illegal immigration of Alexander Belov and its allies. Thus, only groups with coordinators and leaders who maintained a good standing with authorities were permitted to march, no matter how radical or racist their slogans and ideology were. This policy of the Russian authorities is not very new. It is basically the same as in previous years, and we have, like in 4 years ago when they created Rodina Party and then Motherland Party and then destroyed Motherland Party. And we have no doubt that the outcome will be the same. I mean that the overall level of nationalist mobilization will progressively increase. And the last but very important topic is the misuse or abuse, I don't know how to say better, of anti-extremism legislation. Now it is well known that there are many cases of suppressing rights and liberties of Russian citizens under the pretext of fighting extremism, so that's not something new. So I will mention here only several new trends. First, the indeterminate nature of the legal framework as a whole with regards to wide-ranging anti-extremism campaign often becomes an obstacle to the free discussion of the problems of xenophobia and discrimination in mass media. Maybe even it was strange even for me, but in August this year, the newspaper Novaya Gazeta of St. Petersburg, it's a local edition of one of Russian most prominent independent newspapers, received a warning from procuracy for extremism for an article which expressed resentment at intent of this movement against illegal immigration to conduct raids on Georgian citizens residing in Russia. At the same time, the actions of the movement itself didn't attract any attention of law enforcement authorities. And a year earlier, a similar warning was given to the newspaper Izvestia, more official, it's owned by Gazprom Media Holding, for publishing an article about discriminatory practices in Yakutia Republic. In increasing frequency, religious associations are unlawfully prosecuted for extremism. Until recently, this mainly applied to non-mainstream Muslim groups, in particular those in opposition to officially recognized Islamic muftis. But now the circle of the victims has widened considerably. For example, the Islam as it is website, affiliated with the official mosque in Samara city, was found to be extremist and shut down for one article stating that Muslims should not celebrate Nowruz. The court considered this very special confessional issue worthy of administrative prosecution. the opinions of state officials regarding the essence of a religion in connection to anti-extremism legislation have started to have a real repressive impact. The very fact of speaking in favor of Wahhabism have been repeatedly used as a reason for criminal charges. One prominent case involved the conviction against Imam Said Baiburin in Ufa this April. The Imam was accused in extremist activities, which included proselytizing Wahhabist views and distributing forbidden materials, such as the book of the founder of Wahhabism, Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab. This book appeared on the list of extremist materials, and nothing except of that was against the Imam, only these two things. And Baiburin was imprisoned. And 2 days ago, when he his term has been finished, he was unlawfully extradited to Kazakhstan. There have been attempts to close one of the regional organizations of Jehovah's Witnesses, to ban the Watchtower magazine and other publications as extremist. There was even a criminal case initiated in connection to some of the materials published in the Jehovah's Witnesses, by the Jehovah's Witnesses. The same materials which were distributed years before. Even Moscow Baptists, who had never been seen as a public security threat, received such an anti-extremist warning. Such accusations are based on an overly broad definition of extremism, which includes, among the other many other things, incitement to religious discord. In Russian, it's возбуждение религиозной розни, not a hatred, but discord. This provision is understood as a ban of sharp criticism toward anybody's religious views as such. Not only religious groups find that their freedom of conscience is limited by anti-extremism legislation. This May, charges were brought against a well-known human rights defender and equally well-known art expert for organizing the Forbidden Art 2006 exhibition. The accused faced charges of incitement to religious and ethnic hatred, but however, from the letter of accusation, it is absolutely clear that they are actually charged of blasphemy, in particular of insulting Christian symbols. The trial has started already, but presumably will not end in the foreseeable future. And moreover, this September, one of district prosecutor's offices in Moscow issued a warning for extremist activity for one television station for airing an episode from the South Park cartoon. The funny thing is that this episode, which is called Cartoon Wars, is discussing the problem, is it possible, is it extremist, I would say, to show Mohammed in the cartoon. And now this case will be discussed in the court, and the process has already started. At the same time, 2 days ago, another prosecutor's office issued a warning against Russian Newsweek magazine for an article about some conflicts related to Muslims in Germany, and for one picture from this Danish caricatures. I even spent some time to find this picture in the magazine, because it's a very little somewhere in the margins. But anyway, they've got this warning, and it is serious enough. Since various authorities are apparently under pressure from their superiors to step up the fight against extremism, we have also documented a wave of incidental, even absurd, anti-extremism cases. I may talk a lot about that, but just one example. In June, in Novosibirsk region, one court fined for a display of Nazi symbols a participant of theatrical fight between Soviet and German tanks imitating Second World War event. And the guy, Vyacheslav Veryovichkin, he's a well-known craftsman who was reconstructed, I would say, these tanks, which were many times used for making films about Second World War. He was given a warning also under anti-extremism provisions. It could be funny again, but it is not. Not only because people like Veryovichkin are suffering for nothing, but because authorities just imitate fight against really extreme action. I mean, against violent hate crime. They usually are fighting for statistics, not for something real. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sasha. Kathy, we'll go right to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. The sharp deterioration in the human rights climate in Russia appears to be the result of the increasingly authoritarian stance of the Russian government, as well as the growing influence of chauvinist groups in Russian society, which seem to be officially tolerated. Many believe the Russian government officials tacitly or actively support the view of many ethnic Russians that Russia is reserved only for them, that Russian Orthodoxy is the country's so-called true religion, and that Russian identity is threatened by a demographic decline among ethnic Russians. Some observers have suggested that Russian authorities have also manipulated xenophobia for political purposes. Moreover, by issuing nationalistic statements and blaming non-Russians for crime, the Kremlin has encouraged intolerant attitudes towards non-Russians, including non-Russian citizens, of course, and those not identified with the Russian Orthodox Church. Protestant groups in Russia are attacked as dangerous sectarians in public protests by pro-Kremlin nationalist youth movements. In recent years, evangelical Protestants and other minority communities have also been the target of intolerant media attacks and violence, and local authorities, unfortunately, have often not responded adequately. Many of the problems faced by Russia's diverse minority religious communities stem from the statement in the preface to the 1997 religion law that only four religions, Russian Orthodoxy, Islam, Judaism, and Buddhism, have traditional status. Reportedly, the Russian Orthodox Church also sometimes uses its influence on regional authorities to restrict the activities of other religious groups. The Russian Orthodox Church has proposed a voluntary course on the foundations of Russian Orthodox culture, that it be included in the national curriculum, and that course has been introduced in some regions of Russia. Some religious leaders have objected to this course because it implies that only one religious tradition is the basis of Russian culture. Last month, when I was in Moscow, I was told that the Russian Minister of Education is personally opposed to the foundations course. Therefore, as of the next academic year, students in Russian schools will be offered a choice of a course either on ethics or on world religions. And the Russian Ministry of Education is laboring to produce a 300-page textbook on world religions. The foundations of Russian Orthodox culture is supposed to be dropped from the curricula in those regions which have adopted it, and religious figures will be barred from teaching courses on religion. Although the Commission stated in its May 2008 annual report, copies of which are available here, that the Russian government does not have a clear and consistent policy on religious affairs, I believe personally that that may no longer be the case. To quote from a report on religious freedom issued on October 1st of this year by the respected Forum 18 News Service, the gravest current threat to freedom of religion or belief comes from the federal government's approach to combating religious extremism. Included in the extremist law's definition of activity are many references to religion. For example, incitement of religious hatred, propaganda of the exclusivity, superiority, or inferiority of citizens according to their attitude towards religion or religious affiliation, obstruction of the lawful activity of religious associations accompanied by violence or the threat of violence, or committing a crime motivated by religious hatred. So this is quite a context in which to apply the extremism law, and in the also included, of course, in the ways that Sasha has discussed. Furthermore, under new amendments to this law, those who are alleged to have defended or even expressed sympathy with individuals who are charged with extremism are also liable to charges of extremism. In September 2007, a Moscow court upheld a lower court decision to declare as extremist Russian translations of the books of a prominent Turkish Muslim theologian, Said Nursi, thereby banning the distribution of Russian translations of Nursi's writings in Russia. When I was in Moscow, I learned that the Russian translator of Nursi's books was forced to flee Russia due to ongoing police harassment. As is true in many countries, the Russian government does face major challenges as it addresses extremism and acts of terrorism that claim a religious linkage, while also protecting freedom of religion or belief and other human rights. The rapid post-Soviet revival of Islam, along with the aftermath of the war in Chechnya and growing instability in the North Caucasus, have made it difficult for the Russian government to deal with its 20 million strong Muslim population, which is the country's second largest religious community. Security threats from domestic terrorism, particularly those related to the conflict in Chechnya, are genuine. Nevertheless, the North Caucasus region faces chronic instability due to severe unemployment, some radical foreign influences on local Muslims, and the use of arbitrary force by the military against the local population, particularly in Ingushetia. As a result, Muslims increasingly express dissatisfaction with the Russian government. Nevertheless, human rights groups are concerned that official Russian methods used to address security threats could increase radicalism among Russia's Muslim community. Many Muslims are prosecuted for terrorism or extremism, although they have no apparent relation to such activities. Dozens have been detained for possessing religious literature, such as the Quran, or on the basis of planted evidence such as banned literature, drugs, or explosives. Reportedly, at least 200 Muslims have been imprisoned on fabricated criminal charges of possession of weapons and drugs. According to human rights groups, a 2003 Russian Supreme Court decision to ban 15 Muslim groups for alleged ties to international terrorism has made it easier for officials arbitrarily to detain those on extremism charges for alleged links to these groups or merely for possessing the literature of these groups. In fact, it seems that there have been hundreds of Muslims who have been jailed as a result of this court decision. Nevertheless, only 3 years after this decision did the official government newspaper, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, publish the Federal Security Service list of terrorist-designated organizations, which is, under Russian law, a necessary step in order for this decision to have legal force. The Russian human rights group Memorial reports that Muslims who are perceived as overly devout are now viewed with suspicion and may be arrested or even disappeared on vague official accusations of Islamist extremism or for the alleged display of Islamist sympathies, particularly in the North Caucasus. Muslim leaders have also been targeted by Russian officials, again, as Sasha has described, and there are other such cases. The hostile official attitude to Muslims also affects their ability to open and maintain mosques. More than 3,000 Muslims, including four prominent imams, published an open letter to President Putin last year. They asked him to intervene and stop the repression of Muslims in the name of the struggle against terrorism. The letter was published in Izvestia and protested the case of another arrested imam, Anton Stepanenko, who they alleged had only been guilty of converting non-Muslims to Islam. The letter also protested the Nursi legal case, saying it could become, quote, a precedent for banning almost all literature that cites the Quran. To turn to another aspect of this problem, and that is the NGO law and how it affects the Russian communities, religious communities. As is well known, in the start of 2006, President Putin signed a restrictive new law on NGOs, which also includes religious communities. The law enables the Ministry of Justice to initiate court cases to deny registration to religious and other groups that do not meet numerous bureaucratic requirements. Due to protests by many Russian religious groups, including the Russian Orthodox Church, last year reporting requirements under that law were simplified. Nevertheless, last year, the Justice Ministry has taken action in various parts of Russia to deprive many local religious groups of legal status. In October of this year, the Justice Ministry published a list of 56 centralized religious organizations for which it will request deprivation of legal status. That list includes Old Believer, Armenian Apostolic, Catholic, Protestant, Nestorian, Muslim, and Buddhist organizations. Nevertheless, 15 groups on that list had not received any advance warning from the Justice Ministry that they had violated bureaucratic or other requirements. Although 309 of Russia's 562 centralized religious organizations are from the Moscow Patriarchate, however, none of them appeared on the Justice Ministry's list. Reportedly, the Justice Ministry had given the Moscow Patriarchate advance notice on how to file proper reports. If that, in fact, is the case, the Russian Ministry of Justice has violated the Russian constitutional provision that religions are equal under the law. Religious education is also coming under greater state control. Last year, although they had operated for years without education licenses, several religious educational institutions were denied legal status. In March of this year, a list of seven religious organizations was published for which the Justice Ministry will also file a lawsuit to deprive them of legal status. Nevertheless, in June of this year, the Russian Supreme Court struck down a March ruling by the Smolensk Regional Court, which deprived a local Methodist church of legal status for operating a Sunday school, which turned out to be for four children, without an education license. Despite this court ruling, however, other Bible and Quran schools for adults may still be deprived of legal status. Interreligious violence and vandalism of religious property also remain serious problems. Although these crimes are investigated by Russian law enforcement and the judiciary, the Russian Human Rights Ombudsman has noted that very few convictions result. Although most such attacks are motivated by ethnic intolerance, religious and ethnic identities often overlap. Russian officials often display an inconsistent and inadequate record in responding to media attacks and violence associated with anti-Semitism. In various regions of Russia, some 100 small ultra-nationalist newspapers regularly print anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim materials. In conclusion, Russia's religious communities play a key role in civil society that can provide a firm foundation for the state. It is in the Russian national interest to respect diversity and prevent discrimination. I've also got here some recommendations, which I think in the interest of time I won't go into, but we have a long list of recommendations which are available to you and have been distributed. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure they're going to come up as we talk about future policies. And with that, over to you, Ted.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah, for hosting us here for this discussion. And I also have to apologize. I have no excuses for the quality of my English, but I do have a bad cold, so please bear with me with respect to my voice. At Human Rights First, we have a Fighting Discrimination program. I'm the director of that program. Our program seeks to strengthen the response of governments, European governments, North American, former Soviet governments, all the 56 countries of the OSCE, to strengthen their responses to violent hate crime. And in that context, we put out an annual survey for the last few years, a copy of which you see on the table of incidents and our recommendations generally. for the 56 governments of the OSCE and also for the U.S. government. This year, based on some of the situation as described by Sasha and by Kathy, we've put out a special report on Russia that's also out on the table with some specific recommendations for the Russian government. And we've also looked at Ukraine, which I won't really go into, but it's another bad situation for racially and ethnically motivated violence and anti-Semitism in that country, and our Ukraine report is also out there. What I wanted to do, and I'll do it briefly so that we have time for questions, is to talk a little bit about our view of the hate crime situation in Russia, supplementing a little bit on what Sasha is saying, and also our recommendations for U.S. policy to address the problem in Russia. And I think it's obvious to all of us that the conditions that both Kathy and Sasha have outlined, an increasingly aggressive nationalism in Russia, rising violent hate crime, and a weak government response to it, an increasingly authoritarian approach to the anti-extremism campaign, and tensions with Muslims, you know, all of these things represent considerable challenges for U.S. policy. There is no doubt that an increasingly authoritarian Russia is not a reliable global strategic partner for the United States. These problems that we're talking about, they've existed for quite some time. They've been growing for quite some time. People have recognized them and drawn attention to them. And the United States has largely been unable to have much of an impact on those trends, despite the fact that the U.S. has been open in its support for democratic development and the rule of law in Russia. So in this time of transition, I think everyone would agree that there's a need for a fresh approach with respect to U.S.-Russia relations. And what I, you know, what we can have commented on at Human Rights First is just a small segment of that. But even within that segment on the issues that we follow most closely, we see both challenges and opportunities for the United States that exist from the current situation. We'll talk mostly about violent hate crime, where we think there's some opportunity for constructive engagement with the Russians. However, I would want to note another issue, another concern of some importance to Human Rights First, and that is the suppression of independent civil society, touched on both by Sasha and by Kathy. And our view that that in whatever policy takes shape in the coming months and years, the United States needs to be unwavering in its support of independent civil society in Russia. It needs to maintain an open and public dialogue with civil society groups and persons of independent political nature in Russia. It needs to be able to highlight their work, investigate ways to support them financially, and certainly to maintain a vigorous posture to protest any efforts to silence these groups. These are particularly important, should be particularly important aspects of any policy going forward. Now, of course, we have to have a dose of realistic expectations as to the leverage that the United States has on these sensitive political issues, but nevertheless, we feel it's important to continue to try. On the question of hate crime, we think there's a slightly different situation with respect to the opportunity for U.S. policy. We think there is an opportunity there to have a more constructive approach with the Russians, and one that can have a distinctly different tone than on some other human rights issues. In our work on violent hate crime in Russia, we have seen a generally positive response to the recognition that racially motivated, ethnically intolerance motivated, religious intolerance, violence motivated by all these things is a problem that's shared throughout the region. It's a problem here in the United States. It's a problem in the Western countries, in the EU countries, the more economically developed ones. It's also a problem in the East of Europe. And I think this opens up a willingness of the Russians to talk to Americans about the issue. and to possibly share strategies and share best practices and other things to try to address it. The U.S. certainly has an awful lot to offer from its own experience and its own expertise in that area. So let me just briefly mention, again, from our view of what's going on in Russia, what the needs are there, and then briefly some of our recommendations. In our view of, I mean, there's a quite a large number of things that are not very well developed in Russia that are necessary to have a vigorous response to bias-motivated violence. And they're a mixture of I would say, political factors as well as technical factors. Despite some statements from the top, from Medvedev and from Putin, there still is a lack of political will from the top, clearly demonstrated to the Russian public, to the security apparatus in that country, that there will be no tolerance for racial, ethnic, and religiously motivated violence. Whatever messages have been given have not trickled down to any real concerted action by law enforcement and others. So strengthening political will is an extremely important factor. The second thing is that there is largely, I mean, Sasha notwithstanding, who is, I think, the leading light in terms of having any grasp on the situation for violence in Russia of this nature, there's a low NGO capacity to monitor and to advocate on this issue. So that's also something that really needs to be strengthened. We were struck in our look at what's happening in the country that there is also very little coordination and meeting of the minds between victims, largely Central Asians, Caucasians, small religious minorities, coordination between victims, between the community groups that represent victims, human rights organizations, and the police. These groups are operating sort of in different spheres with different interests, pointed in different directions, and until there's more of an alignment and ability to communicate across these groups, it's going to be very difficult to have a really vigorous response. Police are not trained. They're not adequately instructed. Prosecutors also not trained, not well instructed on using the legal tools that exist. But there are also some of the legal instruments could be much stronger in terms of successfully prosecuting some of these cases. For instance, witness protection, juror protection, the ability to enter into evidence, prior bad acts, also the ability to turn one of a group to testify against others. All these things are really not well in place in the Russian legal system as of yet, and they all inhibit the ability of Russian prosecutors to bring cases. And finally, as Sasha said, first off, there is no reliable system of public reporting on the incidents of these crimes. So all these factors put together, create a pretty challenging environment to make a difference, but we do think that there are several opportunities there. So I'll just conclude with a couple of suggestions in that regard, and then we can move on to questions and a discussion. There's really three points that we're making as far as U.S. engagement on these issues. The first one is that the United States should stress in its bilateral relationship that it considers the failure or it considers the violent hate crime and the government's response to it to be a very important issue. And it should be advocating at both a bilateral and a multilateral level efforts to to address those concerns. And I think that, as I said before, the U.S. can really effectively communicate that there's a common interest between the two countries to, you know, to address this problem and to develop solutions to it. Where we would encourage the U.S. to really develop and maintain a regular dialogue with the Interior Ministry, at least try to address all of these deficiencies, many of which the Interior Ministry has some control over. This could be a forum to raise individual cases, but also this discussion should be supported by offers of technical assistance and other opportunities to share information and best practices, which I'll get to in a moment. I think that the issues that we're advocating discussion of and the steps that we think the United States should be pressing the Russians to take are outlined in our report, and they're really based on the things that I've just mentioned. More public statements at the top, more public reporting on the issue, a review of the legal tools that are available, outreach efforts at the local level to build trust, to increase the reporting of hate crimes. I also just briefly mentioned that U.S. ongoing dialogue with the Russian Human Rights Ombudsman, as well as their engagement with the OSCE, and we can talk about that more if people would like to, also presents opportunities for the United States to try to have some influence on this situation. The second point, as I mentioned, is to try to share best practices and offer technical assistance. The U.S. has expertise in the Justice Department, in the FBI, and elsewhere, existing programs, existing people in Russia who have, you know, who have some of the skills and some of the training to be able to try to work with the Russians to disseminate American approaches and materials and discuss the possibility of a more robust system of technical assistance. I'll give you one specific example. The United States has in the past, recent past, offered and given training to Russian prosecutors to present cases before juries. And this really was quite a successful program. The Russians had asked for it, and the U.S. was able to provide it. It turns out that one of the prosecutorial teams that prosecuted a couple of very prominent St. Petersburg hate crime murders were trained under this program and found it to be quite helpful. And this was headed by someone, an American posted in the embassy by the Justice Department, a prosecutor. There are several prosecutors, obviously, in the United States who have quite extensive experience in prosecuting prosecuting hate crimes. So at that level, there can be some engagement. But the final point, and I think this is the one where the U.S. has more ultimately more control over, is its support for civil society organizations in Russia who are trying to combat violent hate crime. And we've had several specific suggestions in that regard. The U.S., the AID, is looking at their next round of human rights and democracy programming. We think that a program on violent hate crime, supporting groups like SASHIS to improve their monitoring, help to try to create local exchanges and local advocacy efforts, increasing coordination and communication at the local level with the police. These are things that USAID should be looking at. The United States also should be more openly supporting the OSCE's program of training civil society organizations on hate crime. The OSCE has a new program, but it's a good one. The U.S. has been supportive of it, but nevertheless not supportive in terms of funding, and we think that that's That's regret, you know, that there hasn't been more more funding to be able to do that. Just one other point on the OSCE. There's a variety of tolerance and non-discrimination programs that they have been engaged on. The U.S. has been a strong supporter of that, as have we at Human Rights First. But again, this question of funding has come up in the last couple of years where there's a lot that could be done, but the U.S. has not been able to or not been willing to provide some of the extra budgetary assistance that is needed to really move those programs forward. So with that, I will conclude and open. Be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have about 35 minutes for Q&A, and I'll start to take a list, and I will ask a few brief questions and then open it up. Sasha, I think some of us might be interested in hearing why this issue for you, how you got into this. I mean, SOVA Center at this point is this one of the main organizations, one of the main human rights organizations that is looking at this issue. There are a lot of human rights challenges before Russia, and it might be interesting to get a sense of why this specific one. But also what you would like to see if you were sitting down with President-elect Obama or his Russia team, what is it that you're going to be looking for? And it could be issues that relate both directly to your work, but more generally. Kathy, I wonder what you think of the idea that we did a study a couple of years ago looking at young males in the North Caucasus and their both religious identity, but also how they were thinking about a variety of political issues. And we actually found that there was not a lot of difference between the Muslims in the sample and non-Muslims, but that people were experiencing a lot of socioeconomic deprivation and that there was a lot of worry that this was going to cause a shift to any kind of radical sentiment, that this is a security concern for the Russian officials. So one, is there a way of reaching out to Russian officials that it's in their own interest to be having different strategies, but also that, you know, the European communities that deal with large Muslim communities and they deal in a very different way. And I'm thinking maybe the Germans might be a country that could speak with Russian officials on different ways of approaching this. And then, Tad, just briefly, what are the international legal obligations that Russia has for treating these crimes, given their membership in the OSCE and the Council of Europe? One of the things I'd like to see happen in the next administration is, and, you know, talk about pie in the sky, but a movement towards a international witness protection regime that you know, prosecution on a number of issues that we're concerned about. We need to have a much stronger regime internationally on witness protection. So why don't we take one or two, and then we'll give you an opportunity to respond. Use your microphone and state who you are.
Sure. Ron McNamara with the Helsinki Commission. I wonder if Alexander could address any reaction to the historic election in the United States and the fact that President-elect Obama is from a minority community, and what the reaction may have been in groups that you're following, as well as the overall global downturn in the economy and what indicators you may be seeing even at this early stage in Russia.
Alex Berezin, Russian News and Information Agency. I have a small question for Catherine. Just you told that there were 200 Muslims who were jailed on fabricated charges. So what is the source of that statistics? Thank you.
Okay. First about why I'm doing that. I didn't perceive myself as human rights activist first. I was a researcher. And in previous organization where I worked, we dealt with many things, and then there were kind of specializations of different groups, and our part of it specialized on nationalism and related issues. That's why. And as I am more a researcher, it's difficult for me to decide what I would say to Barack Obama. But it's really difficult. But what I think maybe is that of course I don't see how presidents communicate with each other, but my impression on current or maybe previous, I don't know how to say, administration was that they agree to not too much criticize Russia for some human rights related things, because Russia is in early in this global fight against terrorism. And I think that that's a mistake, because this ally is non-constructive, at least. Internal policy of Russia, it's more for a future, maybe not so far, it's more produce radicalism and terrorism than suppress it. This criticizing, if to talk about these areas which we are talking about, that pushing Russian government to more constructive inner policy toward radical groups, that's the issue of security also for United States. That's not only about human rights. Even if President Bush, for example, doesn't care about that, I don't know. But that's also an issue of security. At the same time, even if there is a tough, open critics of Russian policies, at the same time it is possible to suggest something like technical help, because such issues like hate crime, they are not an issue of confrontation between Russia and the states, and even the political confrontation inside Russia. I mean, between the government and democratic opposition, which is pro-Western. So it is possible to discuss more or less constructively what can be done regarding hate crime. It's more difficult to discuss what has to be done regarding freedom of election or press, but this issue is easier. And as to reaction to the election results, if you ask about our nationalists who I'm researching, of course they are not happy. But at the same time, most of them think anyway that the United States is the great enemy. So these results even show again how seriously ill is all this Western society. That's, I think, the main massive of comments about that. So it's
thank you, Sarah, for raising the North Caucasus. As you know better than I, probably, it's an extremely complicated part of the world, and Caucasus means apparently language mountain. And there are dozens and dozens of different small nationalities living there, some of which are most of which are primarily Muslim by tradition, some of which are not. The Ossetians, for example, are not. But certainly the role of religion, as was described to me recently in Moscow, is sort of the oxygen or the lack of oxygen of a lot of the conflict that is in endemic, unfortunately, in many of those societies. I should single out from what I was told recently that apparently the situation is particularly severe not only in Chechnya, although at least overtly the conflict there is no longer going on at a very serious level, under the firm hand, to put it mildly, of President Kadyrov, but particularly seriously in Ingushetia and also to some extent in Dagestan. Dagestan, for example, has 30 major languages, so that just gives you a flavor of the diversity in this very small area. As far as Ingushetia, however, is concerned, those of you who follow some of these matters may have noticed that the president of that republic, a former KGB general, Kozyazykov, was recently demoted, or rather fired, and replaced, and the level of violence so far by federal troops against the population, which apparently is causing massive dissatisfaction and social dislocation, has decreased. And interestingly, there was a court decision within, I guess, a few recent days,
day before yesterday,
that a prominent Ingush activist who had been murdered by local official or by the government or at police hands, that case should be re-examined. And I just learned this morning that Zyazikov, the disgraced president, tried to commit suicide. His family got him to the hospital before he actually died. Presumably, this is as a result of this court decision. Now, you know, I obviously, this is an extremely complex problem. Yes, it's true that there's massive social dislocation, huge unemployment, which, of course, affects all people, particularly young men. It's an extremely unstable situation. The government, the Russian government, while on the one hand it does give a lot of financial subsidies to that part of the world, most of that does not reach the people, and the government or the heads of these various republics are in a very ambiguous situation. On the one hand, they're interested in the government, the federal government subsidies continuing to come, but they they're vitally dependent on that, and therefore they're not really independent actors. Anyway, this just gives a minor flavor of the complexity of what's going on. As for other models on how to integrate people of different diverse backgrounds, I think different countries have different things to offer. I'm not sure I would point to Germany as the best model, but certainly it's a better model than France. I think England also has a lot to offer, as do we. So I think these are the kinds of issues, however, that should be more discussed.
Let me just say, I mean, there's a huge difference, obviously, between Russian Muslim population, which is not a migrant population. These are people who've lived, their families have been there for centuries, as opposed to the UK, Germany, or France. In a lot of ways, frankly, the UK, with community policing, is thinking a lot about it. But Russian-UK relations in general are not particularly good, and so that's an impediment. So that's the German case is mostly because there is a special relationship between Russia and Germany. So,
well, hence I would echo those who say that OSCE and other relevant or international organizations should be looked to for bringing together intelligent discussion and, you know, attempts to find better solutions and ways to deal with issues, also including the problems of better integration of migrants, which, you know, of which Russia is number two in the world in terms of numbers of labor migrants. The UN estimate is 12 million. The actual figure is probably much higher. Most of them are from Central Asia and the Caucasus, but that's another question. As for where I got the number of 200, this is based on information from various Russian human rights organizations. But, of course, it would be good to have more official statistics on various kinds of issues, including some of the issues that Tad and Sasha have discussed apropos of hate crimes.
Just to respond quickly on the international obligations on Russia, I think there's three levels where that where they come from. First, with respect to the OSCE, and these are political as opposed to legal obligations, but nevertheless arrived at on consensus basis, there have been declarations that set out clearly an obligation to respond to bias-motivated incidents and prosecute persons who commit them, but also to collect information on bias-motivated violence and to report that to the OSCE. So these are the two main commitments that have been specifically developed there. Under the European Convention on Human Rights, the European Court has been clear that a state is under an obligation to investigate any racial motivation for a crime, including a crime of violence, and that crimes that have a racial motivation and crimes that don't should not be treated on the same basis. So laying the groundwork for enhanced penalties, which Russia has in their law, enhanced penalties for crimes of violence where there's a biased motivation. And then at the UN level, in the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, obviously there's an obligation on governments to secure the right to be free from discrimination and such things as the right to life and the security of the person. So thus the special rapporteurs on racism and religion have both taken up the issue of hate crime and requested information from government. So there's it's not as well developed as one would like to see, but there's a solid basis for there being an international obligation to respond.
Good morning, Jeff Goldstein from Freedom House. Sasha, there have been some fairly scary public survey results showing that young Russians are more nationalistic than the older generation of Russians. And I was wondering if you could comment in terms of hate crimes and nationalist attitudes on the school curriculum. Is it helpful, harmful? Is it being manipulated by the government? And if I could also follow up on Ron's earlier question, I know in the United States, economic bad times tend to result in an increase in anti-immigrant sentiments. There have been a lot of varying things in the press about how economic problems are being felt or not felt by the Russian population. And so are you seeing any indication that economic times are reaching the level where it's causing an increase in hate crimes? Or simultaneously, do you see any danger that if the government is not able to fulfill its social contract with the people, which is we'll give you a better standard of living if you keep out of politics, if that begins to break down, do you think there's a fear that the government could then use immigrants as a scapegoat?
As you're moving, I'll say that CSIS has conducted in 2005 and 2007 surveys of young Russians, and we actually have a lot of data on views of different ethnic groups, religion, organizations like DPNI, as well as NASHI, as well as Memorial, to get a sense of, over time, to what extent young people are gravitating towards various different organizations, but also how young people think about Americans or Georgians or Muslims or Jews, and at some point we should figure out a way to share that information.
Thank you. I'm Lauren Homer. I'm an attorney in private practice. And I wanted to get back to the list of the 56 religious organizations. Given the 2006 regulations or changes to the law and all of the regulations that the Federal Registration Bureau has set up, it's almost impossible for any organization to operate without violating some registration requirement or another. But I'm wondering, and it's kind of addressed to the three of you, whether you see this as perhaps a leading indicator of a trend to start using bureaucratic excuses to close down foreign religious organizations and then ultimately other types of groups that are not preferred in Russia.
Okay, so I will start here. First, about school curriculum. It's a difficult issue. Of course, teachers in school usually do not teach to kill somebody. But even when I know my young colleagues who are trying to make lessons of tolerance, kind of that, in schools, and they met many situations when the teacher, of course, he agreed that tolerance is something nice, but at the same time, the people from Caucasus are something bad, and he's openly speaking about that in the classroom. He even doesn't understand that it's something about one thing. As to curriculum itself, yes, it is a problem. That's not because some special policy of the government, but it's a more serious change which happened in the 90s and which gave the results to these years, that general Marxist paradigm of the history was changed to more ethnocentric explanations of everything. So this school curriculum, of course, it's not the initial reason, but it's a sign of this general trend in the in Russian society. Now, many people, including people with democratic views, they tend to explain social problems in ethnic terms. That's very often happens. Of course, school teaching of history, especially of history, is also one of sources of such an understanding. About crisis, I forgot about this question. Now, there is no serious effect for usual people, I would say. Of course, there are some businessmen which are almost in panic already, but most of citizens do not feel this crisis until now, at least seriously. And but I cannot predict what happens in several months, when because if, for example, our government tries to support the exchange course of ruble to dollar and euro, with the same efforts, they will spend the whole how it calls in English, I don't know. Yes, all the resources, currency and gold resources, yes. Not stabilization fund, but there is stabilization fund. It's already not so huge. So now they spend its
reserves.
Yes, in a so fast that it may be all spent to the spring. And what happens next, nobody knows. And I don't understand which movements will be more effective in using mass disappointment. That's unpredictable. Really nationalist activists look more effective than others. It's easy to see they can gain... without paying money for participation, they can gain more people for the events than any other political movements, at least in Moscow, and not only in Moscow. Now it's not many. This Russian march, it's up to 3,000 people for 10 million population city. Of course, it's a very small manifestation, but it's bigger than others. But we don't know what will happen if more people will be mobilized. Where will they go? And about these bureaucratic procedures, yes, of course, the bureaucratic pretexts are the most common thing, and usually it's much easier than to discuss some political things. I don't know, Memorial Human Rights Center, they had dozens of additional checks, so they practically have it continuously. And that happens not with all organizations. For example, our had no anyone because we do not look oppositional. We are dealing with some... our main issue as a hate crime and xenophobia is something what governments assume as non-oppositional activity. That's we are helpful. So they do not treat us this way, but other organizations are treated this way. And of course, it relates to religious groups also. Thanks, at least to Russian Orthodox Church, these rules were changed for all religious organizations. So now it's more or less possible. But anyway, if somebody wants to find a pretext, it's easy to do anyway.
Well, I think the Russian government took very literally Putin's claim that Russia would be ruled by a dictatorship of the law. it's, you know, as you pointed out, if a group does not meet some very tiny bureaucratic requirement, and if the government chooses to go after that group, they will. As for teaching, you know, the role of tolerance questions in the curriculum, there was a special program on tolerance, which for some reason the Russian government several years ago, when it did have a lot of money, ended early. I don't know why. I think, again, one could turn to OSCE to provide some very useful work with Russian officials, with civil society, and local officials. Both the Russian Human Rights Ombudsman has requested training from the OSCE on international standards of freedom of religion or belief, which could then take part in various parts of Moscow, of Russia, which would be extremely useful. But apparently, you know, there are some funding problems. Another publication that the OSCE panel of experts on religion has recently issued that is teaching about religion from a human rights perspective would also be extremely useful to bring, you know, to have discussions about in Russia. And again, that would be very feasible to do.
Could you say?
We have time for one last round of questions.
Andrei Shirin, Southern Baptist of Virginia. Question for Kathy. It seems that the changes that transpired in the last 10 years put the leadership of the Orthodox Church in an interesting position. On the one hand, obviously, Russian state does everything to prop up Russian Orthodox Church, to kind of publicize it to the population. But on the other hand, the clout that the leaders of the Orthodox Church had seems to have decreased vis-a-vis the government. The government no longer needs them to deliver votes. So basically, they're back to the situation they had before the 90s, which is more or less being Department of Religion of the state, which, and some of the people here may disagree with that, but that's how the Orthodox Church functioned for the most of its history. Would that be an accurate description of the situation, and do you think that may breed some sort of resentment among the top of the Orthodox hierarchy?
Well, I think what you've discussed is very much in play. It's very flexible. Flexible isn't quite the right word, but it's a very dynamic situation. From what I understand, Mrs. Medvedev is extremely devout Russian Orthodox, and works very closely with certain communities. So that may or may not be important. As of course, President Putin also worked with another Russian Orthodox community. Of course, the Russian Orthodox Church is a very large organization, and like any large group, it has many different trends and pressures. There's obviously a very nationalist wing, and some debate whether that's putting pressure on the top leadership or not, and how closely the leadership, especially the patriarch, is included in that. There's also a very important jurisdictional question, and that is if the Ukrainian Orthodox Church, let alone the Estonian and the Moldovan, split away from the Moscow Patriarchate, then the Moscow Patriarchate will in the case of Ukraine alone, lose over half of its diocese. Therefore, the Moscow the Moscow Patriarchate will no longer be the world's largest Orthodox Church. That's also not to say that not those Orthodox groups in Russia which do not, you know, are not loyal to the Moscow Patriarchate do not express, not experience discrimination at the hands of the government. They certainly do. And in some cases, in most cases, have for many years. So it's a very dynamic situation. Finally, I wanted to mention also the case of Bishop Diomede, who is from Siberia, and some of you may have heard of him. He's no one knows. He's garnered 20,000 signatures in his support. He's been extremely critical of the anti-democratic leadership of the Moscow Patriarchate on the one hand. On the other hand, he's extremely reactionary and intolerant in his views towards other religions, other ethnic groups, etc. So he was recently, as in fact I was in Moscow, deprived of his bishop rank, and he's now a monk. However, and some say that actually frees him up to deploy his, or to pronounce further through the internet on his views, which are quite. On the one hand, he is trying to democratize in a certain way the Moscow Patriarchate, but on the other hand, a lot of his views are extremely intolerant.
Yes, Kathy Fitzpatrick. I'm with the Jacob Blaustein Institute, New York. I just wanted to look at this in a slightly different way. I know Ted has suggested the idea of sort of the bilateral or sort of universal approach, which we know does have some effect, where we say, you know, we all have these common problems. You know, we have racism, we have global warming, let's work on them together. What I'm concerned about, though, is that masks a really grave disproportion between the two countries with the kinds of incidents that you see in Russia. I mean, in Russia we're talking about, you know, practically weekly murders, beatings, and so on, and not just of the ethnic minorities or religious minorities, but the people who defend them. So there, it suggests that there's actually sort of more will and intent going on with, you know, when someone like the professor in St. Petersburg is gunned down, or when you have, you know, this week when a foreign NGO anti-fascist activist is beaten and warned. So, you know, that suggests that there's complicity at some level. I mean, either it's, you know, lower levels of government, or there's some moral support, logistic support of some of these racist movements, and you don't have goodwill. So I think when you're dealing with that sort of grave a problem, it's not a workshop. You know, it's you have to be able to maybe ratchet it up and say, given that the Russians have a demonstrated desire now to renegotiate Helsinki, they want to have a new security arrangement. They want, you know, they don't like NATO expansion, the Czech radar stations, all that's understandable. So you can say, if you're going to renegotiate Helsinki, okay, let's put all the Helsinki baskets back on the table. Let's have human rights, the whole package. Let's have racism, media, electoral, religious freedom. Let's put it all back and look at it all and see the ways in which they're connected, that you move forward in one area, and then you're going to see less of these tensions and less of this willingness to do aggressive actions like expand NATO or put in, you know, Polish missiles. It's just my...
Before we go to your final statement, just to complicate Kathy's interesting comment, I was at the Council on Foreign Relations on Saturday night and saw President Medvedev speak, and the question came up of what is the intention of this new collective security arrangement that the Russian government has floated, and it doesn't seem clear at all that there's any content to it. But I'd be very curious to hear your views of whether you think it's a good idea to sit down with the Russian government to talk about this, because I think it is an issue that is going to come up very quickly before President-elect Obama, and it's something that his team is going to need to decide. And on that, Ted, I want to push you just a little bit. I mean, I'm critical of the Bush administration on many issues, including their cutting of foreign assistance and specifically democracy assistance. But I can imagine if I were sitting in the State Department, you could make the argument that this administration has sat down and had open dialogue with Russian civil society. They have continued to support, even in a very difficult budget environment. democracy and human rights. We need to have what more do we need? Plus, let me tell you, there are a lot of people in Washington who are making the argument we need Russia for, and then you fill in the blank. It can be Iran, North Korea. There's a real need to articulate concretely why what happens inside Russia matters for national security, U.S. national security, and frankly, Russian national security, and to connect that. And then one last question for Sasha. If you had, let's imagine there's no international financial crisis at the moment. If you had all the resources that you needed, what would you be doing differently than you're doing now? Is it more monitoring? Is it different kinds of monitoring? Is it outreach to the public? Would it be surveys? All of the above, or something else?
Thanks. I didn't want to suggest that the U.S.-Russia engagement, even on the violent hate crime, was a matter of just sitting down for a workshop. I think as I mentioned, it is important for the United States to continue to raise human rights abuses with the Russians and to raise it in a public way, and to be clear that it has a negative impact on U.S.-Russian relations. And at the same time, while it's, you can't make direct comparisons between the situation in the United States and the situation in Russia, the United States did have a much more extreme problem with some of these issues in the past. We're suggesting it as a way to get to some of the people who have their own interests, some of the law enforcement people who may have their own interests in creating some improvements on the ground. There's some indication that there's interest among some of those people to try to take advantage of, as Sasha says, that there's a situation that is not seen in the current environment as a politicized issue. So there might be some possibilities there. I think that's what we're trying to take advantage of. And maybe we're trying to have our cake and eat it too, but we're not suggesting that there be any ratcheting down of U.S. Condemnation of problems in Russia. As a matter of fact, we've been critical of that there hasn't been enough of that in the past. And I think that on the question of the, security, new security arrangements, our view is we've seen for several years now an increasing Russian attack on the OSCE. There's been a lot of investment in trying to protect that. And I think that's something that should go on and that the new administration should take up at a higher level. We've seen that there's been a diminishing of high-level interest in what's going on at the OSCE over the last several years, whether it's with the budget or with direct diplomatic engagement. If you begin to open these things up again, it seems to me the only purpose of that is to sweep aside some of these irritating things from the Russians' point of view. Elections and election monitoring, human rights, all these issues that they would like to see go away, that they've been objecting to. I think if you open that up, that would be a big mistake. And that goes directly to the point of why it's important for U.S. interests to have the only international grouping where the U.S. and the Russians sit together to be focused on a broad range of issues and not just what we need Russia for. It seems to me that is signaling that we're willing to give away too much in that regard.
Well, I largely agree with what Tad has said, and those of us who've been involved with OSCE in one way or another for many years see, in a sense, it's gone full circle. in the days just after OSCE was signed in 75, or I should say CSCE in those days, the Soviet Union kept stressing the security basket. And surprise, surprise, it is again in a different context, obviously, but I think one needs to keep in mind that one of the unique things about OSCE is its broad definition of security, which obviously brings in the so-called human dimension. That needs to be obviously an integral part, and we shouldn't allow that to be diminished. But it should be done in an intelligent way. It shouldn't be done just finger-pointing. It should be done, you know, digging in on hard issues, which we do all share. Of course, you know, as you said with a certain acerbic comment that it shouldn't just be a workshop. No, it shouldn't just be a workshop, but the full range of issues has to be taken very seriously into account. And unfortunately, the United States has shown in the last few years that it's not taking OSCE or the full range of issues properly into account, both through its budget, the problems with the budget, but also the level and the type of political involvement by the Secretary of State.
Sasha?
Okay. First, I would add a couple of words about Russian Orthodox Church, what was asked, maybe because it's especially interesting for me. The position of the church is really very controversial. They are not a ministry of religion. They are not a ministry because the authorities, they try to keep distance with them. Not only the church seeks for some independence, but the government, they do not like any independent actors, even potentially independent actors. So they do not like to give too much strength to the church also. And they use the symbolic resource and pay for that, but not too much. They pay money, but they do not agree, for example, to start this Orthodox curriculum in schools. That's all some long story, but it's visible that the government is not agree to pay too much for this symbolic support. Then what I would do if I don't know, had a lot of money.
It's not only actually
yes,
just about money. It's
yes,
also
yes,
about
I understand.
Capital.
Yes, of course. Yeah. That's what's a big problem. First, our work is has to be extended geographically. We have regions in the country about which we practically know nothing. That's a problem. And now we are dealing, doing this monitoring not about everything what is really important, even in this sphere. We are mostly doing about manifestations of radical hate speech or about violence. But in Russia, we have no at all any monitoring of practical, I would say, discriminations in workplaces, mm-hmm. in housing, and in many spheres. It's an open sphere, and nothing is done. There is a serious need to work with the youth groups of different kinds. There are people who are doing this job, but again, it must be seriously extended. And the researches which we are doing, I understand how weak they are really. We would like to have much more serious research and more detailed. And that's again not only about violence, while it is important, of course, but all these things related to religion and society conflicts. They are also underreported. There are several groups in the country who are doing this monitoring, and all these groups, including ours, are very weak in that. We have no funding for that, for example, at all. And others also have very small, I know. And about why it is the security issue for the United States, what's happening in Russia. Adding to what I have said before, I think that, of course, the current government in Russia is not very pleasant, but at least it is more or less understandable now for, I think, I mean, for American politicians and experts. But this vertical of power, it is not forever. At some time, I don't know, in several years, maybe 10 years, it doesn't matter how many years, this system will disappear this or that way. And it is better to think now what will happen next, which kind of movements, what kind of elite groups will be involved in this next authorities. Now it's very really difficult to predict it, but there is a possibility that much more dangerous people may come who do not feel even such limitations which current leadership feels.
Thank you. I want to direct your attention to our website, www.csis.org/HRS, and if you go to the North Caucasus page, you'll see a new report that we issued yesterday that traces incidents of violence in the North Caucasus. We've been doing it pro bono for several years, and I think the war in the South Caucasus, we decided that we really needed to get this information out because there's a lot of stuff going on in the North Caucasus. Also, on December 5th, in this room at 10:30, Ted Gerber and I are going to present results from a survey that we did earlier this year of 2,000 young Russian women ages 16 to 34 years old on a variety of issues, including the impact of Prime Minister Putin's maternity capital and how Russian women are thinking about having children, knowledge of and experiences with human trafficking. We also have a lot of data on experiences of discrimination and harassment in the workplace and educational institutions in that same survey. And I don't know that we'll be able to address all of those issues in that meeting, but if not, we'll do a follow-on session, and we invite you, if you're interested, to come. We'll let you know more in the coming days. So please join me in thanking our presenters, and thank you.